CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 89 with Dr. Edward Holland, the Cincinnati procedure for ocular surface transplantation. This is amazing. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. Today I have a very special guest. I've got Dr. Ed Holland, who is everything about cornea and more. Ed, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Now, I did some background research, so I know your dad was an ophthalmologist.
Correct, yeah.
You're one of eight kids.
And he wanted all of us to be ophthalmologists. But only,
now, that is ambitious. How many turned out to be ophthalmologists?
Well, my brother's an optometrist, but his son's an ophthalmologist.
That counts.
Yeah.
So that's pretty good odds. That's like two out of eight.
Yeah, not bad. Yeah.
I'm 0% of my kids, so better than me.
Yeah. My kids have all gone into business.
You add these days with the current state of medicine, maybe even smarter.
Yeah. You got to wonder.
Now tell us about your path in ophthalmology. Everyone knows, like, I have your book here, the cornea book on my shelf. It's edited by you for the last, maybe four or five editions.
We're actually right now editing our sixth edition.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's been a labor of love.
How did you get to specialize into a few hundred microns of tissue? Your whole career.
So, it's very, very funny you say that in the way you say it. So my oldest brother was an emergency room physician. And so, 10% of emergency visits are actually eye related. A lot of people don't know that. He was really good with the slit lamp because of my dad and me. So I sent him our first edition of Cornea was three volumes. And I sent him it, and he calls me up and says, thanks for the books, but how can you have three volumes on a piece of tissue, 550 microns and, 12 millimeters in diameter? I mean, how do you write three volumes, So I will tell you, I've told the story a lot, and as you get older, you certainly remember the people that most influence you. I grew up in Illinois. I went to med school in Chicago. I was originally from the South Side. I've got a lot of cousins and a lot of my brothers and sisters live in Chicago. And my path was to get into ophthalmology and then go back and live in the western suburbs of Chicago and have a nice general practice, And so I was fortunate to match at University of Minnesota. And, my mentor was, probably the best known ophthalmologist in the world right now, Richard Lindstrom. And my first rotation as a resident was his cornea service. And it was unbelievable. He was inventing choroidal storage media that we now still use. He was in the PERC study. He was inventing his three-piece posterior chamber lens when everybody else was doing intercap surgery. So I'm like, boy, these ophthalmologists are pretty good, So at the end of my first year, he called me into his office and Dick said to me, tell me your plans. You've really worked hard as a resident here. At your first year, what are your plans? I said, well, Dick, I'm going to finish up and go to, go back to Illinois. And there's a couple practices I know, and I'll join one of those practices. And he had this pause and he said, you could do that, or you could do something meaningful with your life.
No pressure.
He said, listen, if you you continue to work hard. I was doing research in cornea, and he said, I want you to come back and join our faculty. So really, I had not really thought about a fellowship. I'd like cornea, but it was the mentoring of Dick Lindstrom that really and many milestones in my career that I needed guidance. Dick was the guy that I really went to, and he's really been a great person in my life.
Yeah, to generations of ophthalmologists, even to me, 15 years ago, maybe 12, 15 years ago, I was really having a tough time not seeing my kids enough and traveling too much for ophthalmology.
Yeah.
And Dick said, he says, spend some time with your kids, enjoy your kids. Ophthalmology will always be here. So I did zero eye meetings for 8 years and only just did fun stuff with my kids, family trips.
That's incredible. And that's, you to be admired for that, because, you've got the drive like everybody else does. I read your article in OSN, every issue, and you obviously have a drive to contribute. But to step back and say, I'm gonna hold my career and do what's right for my kids. I think back, you know, I look at young doctors now, and there's actually just an article in the Wall Street Journal just last week on
I read it.
Work-life balance. You know, I mean, sometimes I think maybe it's going too far the other way, but I do think, you know, our generation and the generation before us, you know, there was not a lot of balance. And you know, I look back and I probably could have spent a little more time. And I think that my youngest child gets more of my time than my oldest child. They debate on who's the lucky one.
Right.
I didn't know that a bunch. I do remember you as a rising star, and then you
disappeared.
Yeah, I kind of now it all, and then now you're back, right? Now
right.
We see you a lot more now. So that's a very interesting thing you did, and I'm very, very, I admire you for doing it.
Oh, it was thanks to his great advice. And I'm happy because my kids are mid-20s, both live out of state, and maybe I see them a couple times a year.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's
so my youngest daughter is 15, and my wife just read to me this, by the time your child is 15, you spend 90% of all the time you'll spend with them.
Oh, wow.
Think about that.
And you put it that way.
After age 15, it's 10% of our time is going to be with them. Think about that.
Wow,
that's pretty incredible.
Right. Right. Even when my kids will come home for winter break, I maybe see them a couple of days. Most of the time, they're with their friends.
Yeah. Yeah. And my daughter now, 15, she's always with the friends. You know, we try to, you know, I mean, you know, it's that when they get 12, 13, all of a sudden it's friends over parents, you know. So, but as you know, I have a 29-year-old boy and a 21-year-old daughter. They're actually, when they get a little bit older, they want to
come back.
Come back and spend time with us. So
I'll take what I can get. Now, when you were about that age, so you were, let's say, 29, 30 years old, finished your residency, you decided then to go to Iowa for cornea.
Correct. Yeah. And this is another Dick Lindstrom story. So Dick offered me the job. I said, Dick, I'll just do a fellowship with you. He said, no, you can't. You got to go learn from somebody else. You got to go somewhere else. And of course, University of Iowa was incredible. Jay Kretschmer was a very, very well-known, in the peak of his career. He says, you go to Iowa and then come back and bring something back to us. I said, okay. In the middle of my year, he calls me and said, how are things going in Iowa? I said, great. You know, he said, I've been thinking we need something else at the University of Minnesota. And I said, because there were three cornea people, Dick and two other general cornea people. He said, you would just be the fourth general cornea person just doing PKs like us. He said, why don't we build a high-risk corneal transplant service? Why don't we specialize in that? And I had done some research in immunology, and he said, I want you to go do another fellowship and learn about immunology and immunosuppressive medications and things like that. And I said, Dick, I'm broke. My car's falling apart. You and I had a deal. And he said to me, this is what the University of Minnesota needs. This is what my service needs. And this is what I want you to do. And I said, well, I appreciate that, but I'm gonna come back next year. He said, okay, here's the deal. If you don't do another fellowship, you can't come back. So that led me to go to the National Eye Institute.
Okay.
Where Bob Nussbaum and Alan Palestine were really the pioneers of systemic immunosuppression. Now, they were primarily doing it for uveitis, of which I was managing those patients. But at any eye, you can do anything you want to do. So I started a cornea service there, and we started doing high-risk corneal transplants, you know, previous multi-rejected transplants, and using systemic immunosuppression. And it was like, you know, so I got very, very comfortable with that. So I came back to Minnesota, you know, and, you know, once you say you'll take care of a high-risk cornea, they come from everywhere, right? And Uday, there basically were two groups of patients. I didn't know that at the time. But this one group we would use back then, it was Imuran and Cyclosporin. We don't use those very often now. But and they did great. And another group that was on the same systemic, they did terrible. And I had all these patients that would fail and fail and fail. Well, that was prior to our knowledge of what limbal stem cells were. So, you know, no one really knew. I mean, the translational research of how corneal epithelium, you know, originated and how it was propagated, that came around 1988, 89, 90, 91, and all the research, you know. So the groups that were doing well is what I now call the immunologic high risk. Those were pure transplant rejection patients, maybe a previous corneal scar or herpetic, and they were just pure immunologic. We fixed all those. The ones that kept failing were the chemical injury patients, Stevens-Johnson patients, congenital aniridia patients. They all failed because conjunctiva invaded the cornea. Then they rejected. Then they failed. We didn't understand that. And so then realizing, well, you don't have a source of corneal epithelium, you got to go get that, you know, and either, you know, a deceased donor or a living related, you know, match. But it was the key to it, because in 1990-91, kind of a lot of cornea people started doing ocular surface stem cell transplantation using prednisone orally and maybe a little bit of 2-3 months of oral cyclosporine. That was it. They all failed.
It's not enough.
Like doing a kidney transplant and using 3 months of immunosuppression. In fact, you know, we work with the kidney team at University of Cincinnati. Our rejection rate of ocular surface transplantation is a little bit higher than renal. So what my training, you know, end up going to NEI and learning how to use these medications, we decided to go all in and do exactly what renal did. And we started having good results when all these other cornea centers were having, you know, there was a time between 1990 and 2000 where everybody thought all these procedures failed, which they did if you didn't use immunosuppression. They kind of thought we were maybe making up our data. When we started publishing, we had a 72% success rate. And like, well, why is only the guy in Cincinnati can have success, nobody else? We were the first, and really for the longest time, the only ocular surface transplant group using full immunosuppression. And that goes back to Dick Lindstrom making me do a fellowship at NEI, you know, and building a high-risk transplant service, which really got me into which is what I spend a lot of my time, and that's ocular surface stem cell transplantation.
Now, did he let you come back to the University of Minnesota, though? Finally.
I did. I got to go back, you know, and I was there for 13 years and build a practice, but things were changing. Dick left the university. The inefficiencies of University of Medicine were driving me crazy. And I found this incredible, you know, situation here in Cincinnati where I could be part of Cincinnati Eye Institute, which I give Bob Osher credit. Bob Osher's vision many, many years before I got to CEI was, why do all fellowship people have to be at a university? You know, why don't we build a really high quality, efficient, you know, fellowship trained practice with retina, glaucoma, cornea, you know, oculoplastics, but not be burdened by inefficiency at University of Medicine. But it really worked out even better because I joined CEI, but I had a joint appointment at the University of Cincinnati. So we have med students, residents, fellows, and my collaboration with the renal transplant team at UC, which is, you know, transplant immunosuppression is a field to itself. You know, when you have these patients, you can't, you know, have a rheumatologist or an oncologist. They don't use the same medications and they don't use the same kind of treatment paradigm. And so we really needed a partner with renal because renal invented the specialty. This move to CEI, University of Cincinnati, you know, allowed my ocular surface transplant program to really blossom. And, you know, when I joined Minnesota, they had a really, really great faculty, but a lot of them over the years left for the same reason, you know, Dick left and I left. I joined CEI, you know, we have incredible oculoplastics and glaucoma and retina, and very deep, right? And, you know, we have Mike Snyder, you know, one of the great, you know, complex anterior segment surgeons, you know, as part of our team. So, you know, when you take care of these really complicated patients, you know, over half of them have bad glaucoma. All the chemical thermal injury, Stevens-Johnson patients, they all have lid problems, you know. A lot of them get retinal attachments, the trauma patients. So to have a team of ophthalmologists that could be on our team was, that's CEI. You know, it's been a blessing to work at a place like Cincinnati Eye Institute.
Oh, it sounds amazing. And you've built up basically the world's largest practice of ocular surface transplantation.
We have.
That's amazing.
It's it's a labor of love, but we have. But we're now. I don't know if you know. We started a foundation to try. So this is kind of off our original topic, but as long as we've gone down this road, we tried to teach other cornea people how to do this, right? So we've published over 100 papers in the field of ocular surface stem cell transplantation. We've written a book specifically on this topic, but we really haven't moved the needle. You know, there's a handful of my former fellows who go out and do this, but 99% of cornea surgeons don't do it. And either the patients are told, we're going to just do a routine PK, which failed 100% of the time, and we'll do another one and another one and another one, or there's nothing to do, or if they've done research and found out about us, the patients are told, you can go to Cincinnati, but you're going to be put on these meds and you're going to die. I swear to God, they're told that all the time. So we decide, I actually didn't decide, but a group of people, business people, headed by Bob Dempsey. Bob got a start. He was with Allergan and B&L. And then he was the guy at Shire that got Xiidra, you know, over the finish line. But Bob started a foundation to create the same centers of excellence for ocular surface transplantation that what we do in Cincinnati, we're going to recreate. Instead of hoping someone will pick up what we do, we are going out, finding young corneal surgeons, bringing them to Cincinnati, training them. And one of the big roadblocks is if you have a kidney transplant, the person you spend most of the time with is a transplant coordinator, a nurse, right? So if you go to, you're not talking to the surgeon, you're not really talking to the nephrologist that much. You're spending a lot of time with a transplant coordinator. All his or her time is covered by a code that you, if she talks to a patient for 20 minutes on the phone, she can bill for that time. We have the same issues. You know, we're immunosuppressing just like renal. We have patients that have to get labs 6 times, 8 times a year. Well, you start adding up a lot of patients, you have all those labs. A corneal surgeon can't do that. You absolutely have to have a transplant coordinator. We don't have any codes that will pay for that person's time. And so what we do when we build a center is we train the surgeon, but we raise money to pay for the transplant coordinator. That's how we get these centers started.
So interesting.
And so our goal, and this, it's a bunch of really good people on our board. I didn't start it, but it's called the Holland Foundation for Site Restoration. I didn't want my name on it. I wanted to call it, Udi, tell me about this name, the Ocular Surface Stem Cell Transplantation Foundation. All the business guys said that's too long of a name, so we're going to change it. So they call it the Holland Foundation. But our goal is to build 10 centers in the United States. So 2 years ago, we partnered. This was out of Roger Steiner, you know, somebody right back here. Roger came to me about 5 years ago and go, why are you doing this in Cincinnati and I'm not doing this in Southern California? And I said, Roger, shame on you guys. It was Roger's dream. And he actually got me an appointment at UC Irvine. I was an adjunct professor. I went to UC Irvine several times and operated with Marjan Fareed.
Oh, fantastic. Helped
train Marjan. So Marjan and UCI was our first center outside Cincinnati. We opened about 18 months or two years ago, raised money. You know, she is now managing over 100 patients with ocular surface stem cell deficiency. Wow. And so our second center, we had a press release when we were at AAO. There's a little place in Boston you might have heard of called Mass Eye and Ear.
Heard of it.
Yeah. So they are our second center of excellence. Tom Dolman, the grandson of Klaus Dolman, and Jia Yin, those two young corneal surgeons, are now, they've both been here with me. Thomas was just here last week. We now have given them, we've started the program, we've identified a transplant coordinator. They are now the second center. We've got 5 more centers in the queue to raise money, and basically now we will be able to, throughout the country, tell patients where to go so they don't have to all come to Cincinnati.
That is fantastic. I would have never guessed that it's the transplant coordinator who's kind of the linchpin in the whole process.
So you think about that, you know, after you do 10 or 15 of those, and you know, how are you going to, you know, the corneal surgeon isn't comfortable with meds anyway, but then tracking all the labs, and you know, these patients need to be interfaced with retina and glaucoma. And so, you know, I have a full-time transplant coordinator, and we have over 500 patients on immunosuppression. She tracks all those patients, you know, and you know, you have to have them adequately immunosuppressed, and you got to make sure they don't get sick. And there's lots of issues, but we also have the backup of the head of renal at UC. When we get a complication, he is on our team. We tell him what we need to do, switch these meds, you know, and so here's how you handle it and stuff. So it's a team, and you know, we've kind of published how we approach these patients. It's called the Cincinnati Protocol. And every center is going to basically follow our treatment paradigm. And, you know, we can get good results everywhere.
Now, if you have any plans to get this worldwide, other countries, I know you've done a lot of charity trips. You've done the Armenian trips a couple of times.
Yeah. So we have a Clara Chan at University of Toronto. So she is part of our group. It's interesting. It's the rules in Canada are a little different. We just can't give them money for a transplant coordinator. So we're working in kind of a different way. And we actually have had, there's a big ophthalmology program in Tel Aviv. And we have corneal surgeons that have come and learned from me. And I was headed over there. I was supposed to be there in October of this year to start that program. And then, of course, the war broke out and everything's on hold. But the people we're working with, they take care of everybody in the Middle East, you know, every religion, every country. It's a tremendous eye hospital. And I know someday we will get that up and running. We're also working with the Sardicola Clinic in Grosseto, Italy, as a site in Europe. But our primary focus right now for the raising money is to open, you know, The next site we hope to be fully funded for is University of Illinois Chicago, a great corneal surgeon there, Ollie Jalili, and that's a great department with a lot of great cornea people. So that one's next in the queue.
Oh, that's fantastic! So yeah, you'll have hopefully 10 of these or a dozen of these in the U.S. and then get more.
Then Uday, maybe I can retire. You know, maybe.
Nah, you know, it's in your blood. Who's gonna edit the seventh edition? Come on. You're gonna have this on your radar coming up in like 6, 8, 10 years from now. Tell me about you've done a lot of trips to Armenia where you were very instrumental in, you know, bringing more advanced corneal surgery there.
So we, you know, the Armenian Eye Care Project, you know, you meet some people and they, Roger Hovhannissian, and, you know, obviously you can't say no to Roger, right? So they had never, you know, there's a huge need, and they didn't really have a corneal surgeon. So they brought one of their surgeons over, and she spent a month with me. And then I brought some eye bank people over, and we brought corneas, but more importantly, started talking about how to set up a relationship where we can get corneas supplied to Armenia. But, you know, they have an interesting thing. They have a truck, a mobile truck. You know, Orbis has a plane. Armenia has a truck. So I did the first corneal transplant in the back of a semi. I think that's the first one ever. But in the back of a semi where they're mobile, we're out in somewhere in the middle of Armenia doing corneal transplants. So
that's pretty innovative. So they built out basically a large truck.
Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, you know, I've done lots of Orbis trips, and what a great organization. And the plane flies all over the world. But this is a really innovative idea. You know, they can't get all the patients. And a lot of it's cataract, as you would guess. They can't get all the patients to Yerevan, the capital. So they built this mobile operating room in the back of a semi-trailer, and it's fantastic. Part of the trailer is for diagnostic, you know, exam and diagnostic, and then part of the trailer is an OR. And we said, let's try a corneal transplant there. So that's what we did.
So I'm guessing there's probably no good eye bank there. So you bring your own tissue then, your own corneas.
Well, we set up a relationship where U.S., you know, over 10% of corneas that are procured in the United States are sent OUS. So, I mean, you know, Corey, you know, we can talk about what I think is going to be the first huge breakthrough. So 16 million bilaterally blind people in the world. Okay. That's probably a low estimate. And, you know, half of them have endothelial disease. And so one of the most incredible projects that's happening right now is endothelial cell therapy. And I don't know if you've kind of followed how it's really progressed dramatically. If you want
not to enough, tell me. Not enough.
So you know, Shigeru Kinoshita at Kyoto Prefecture University had this idea that he could actually get endothelium to grow. You know, and everyone kind of thought he was crazy about 15 years ago. But his idea was, if I could culture endothelial cells, I can treat endothelial disease, you know, with cultured cells, not with, you know, back then a PK, then it was a DSEC, and now it's a DMEC. And the reason why is, number one, you can get a lot more cells if you culture them and inject them. Number two, at that time, he thought one donor could potentially treat 50 patients, you know. So, okay, wow. Now we have a technique. So Dr. Kinoshita, through the regulations of the Japanese equivalent of the FDA, could only do certain number of patients, and they watch him for a certain number of years. So it took a while, but he published his first, I think, 12 patients in the New England Journal of Medicine about 4 years ago. You don't get too many ophthalmology papers in the New England Journal of Medicine, you know. So right. On taking patients with pseudophakic bolus, using cultured cells, injecting. So what he does is he wipes off the diseased endothelium, leaves decimase intact. He then injects roughly about 1 million cells.
Okay.
Flips the patient over so they're face down, kind of like in a retina, you know, head position they do for a gas mobile retina. And then they have them lay in the recovery area for 3 hours. They get up, they're done, they go home. No positioning. So wow. Number one. So
it adheres like that?
What's that?
The cells will adhere?
Yeah, so the cells with gravity just start adhering to the back of the cornea. So I went over to Kyoto probably first. I've been there twice watching his work, maybe two or three, no, but about 4 years ago, first time. I saw this 80-year-old guy, and of course they have all the, and they're very, very detailed in the data. The photo of his pre-op, his cornea was, you know, 800 microns, bullous keratopathy. Here's an 81-year-old guy, 2 years out from endothelial cell therapy. His cell count's 3,000.
3,000?
3,000. Three. That was more than you when you were 15. I mean, so CorneaGen IBEG in Seattle, you know, really with Bill Link and Dick Lindstrom on the board of CorneaGen, you know, if you think about innovation, we've had a lot of innovation in cornea, you know, I mean, endothelial keratoplasty, tremendous innovation. Although, you know, it takes a lot of money to innovate. And their idea was, let's build a for-profit eye bank, raise money,
yeah,
like they did in the tissue bank industry. You know, 50% of all tissue banks are for-profit to raise money to invest. So CorneaGen raised a bunch of money to basically purchase the intellectual property of Professor Kinoshita's work and bring it back to the States. What they did then was spun out a biotech company called Orion Biotech. And Orion Biotech, and Shigeru and his team couldn't commercialize it. It was going to cost way too much money. That's what the investment's for. So Orion Biotech, of which I'm the chairman of the medical advisory board, said, okay, we have to take this. I think Shigeru over the 10-year period did about 65 cases. Okay. But we now have to get it commercialized, and we have to go through the FDA trials. So instead of starting with the trial here, because, you know, DSEC and DMEC is so good,
right?
You know, we want to do a proof of concept trial, and we decided to do it in El Salvador for a couple reasons. There's a great clinic called the Casada Clinic. They do a lot of clinical trials with U.S. companies. Number two, there's no corneal surgeon. There are no corneal surgeons in El Salvador.
Oh, wow.
So they've never had, you know, any, I mean, there may have been a few corneal transplants over the years, but they don't import corneas. They don't have a corneal surgeon. So there were a big, big need. And we thought, even if we're only 50% successful, we're going to see if this works or not. So we took cultured cells and on three different trials, we we did basically Shigeru Kinoshita's technique with some modifications as we built built a team of surgeons, John Bernal, Liz Yu, Matt Gigignac, and myself, the four of us, went down there, you know, three different times and did the trials. And again, Uday was unbelievable. We'd have cornea. These weren't Fuchs, which is what we mostly treat here. These were bad pseudophakic bullets.
PPK.
900 micron cornea. Wow. So we'd have to peel the fibrosis off the anterior cornea just to get a view in the anterior chamber. 6 months later, these corneas are 550 microns. The vision went from count fingers to 20/30. So that was the 87 patient proof of concept trial. Now we're ready to say, okay, we can do U.S. patients because the bar is DMEC, right?
Right.
The bar is
high DMEC. Bar.
It's a high bar. So went to the FDA, you know, and so we did the first just completed. Well, the phase two trial, the U.S. was recruited in the spring. I think last patient in was this summer. We're looking for data readout November, December of this year on 100 patients in the phase two trial. If the data is what we think it's going to be, then we do the phase three trial next year. And then hopefully that trial will lead us to approval. So here's what we've learned over the last 4 years of OD. It's pretty amazing. So Orion has got an incredible team of, you know, cell biologists and really innovative biotech people. They now have improved on the original cell culture work. They have more pure cell cultures. They have more viable cells. They think one donor can treat 1,000 patients.
Wow.
Think about that.
So you just keep what I've learned,
because you culture so many cells and you off one donor. So what I've learned through all my years in Orbis is, you know, we're so fortunate in this country to have, you know, incredible, you know, resources and innovation and yet you go to these other countries and, you know, you can't build a U.S. type I bank.
Right.
Money, financial reasons, political reasons, and lots of politics, international medicine, cultural reasons. There's so many reasons you can't build a Western IBank system. But what I've realized going all over the world is there's incredibly brilliant people everywhere.
Sure.
Incredibly good surgeons. You know, you travel and see these surgeons doing stuff, you know, I couldn't do it. They don't have the equipment we have, and you see them do amazing. Yeah. So we can't ship one cornea to one blind person. We can ship cryopreserved cells anywhere in the world, possibly have a shelf life of 6 months. And there are incredibly talented surgeons that will easily be able to take those cells and cure endothelial disease all over the world. To me, it's such an exciting project because it's the first time in cornea we'll be able to start reducing corneal blindness. This is the first technique that will, you know, and you know, Professor Kinoshita deserves all the credit. It was his idea, and we've just built on his genius to really do something what I think is going to be incredibly meaningful.
Well, the neat part there is that, you know, it could be shelf stable for 6 months.
So they just the last trip down to El Salvador was a trial on cryopreserve. We were using, you know, logistics. We were using cells within 72 hours. The next step is to cryopreserve cells and see if the cryopreserve cells will work as good as the fresh cells. We think they will, but you know, if you can cryopreserve cells, you can ship them anywhere, and you know, anywhere in the world, someone takes a vial of a million cells. You know, these surgeons will be able to do this. I mean, it's pretty exciting stuff.
Well, the other amazing part is how you can get that exponential growth of cell culture, right? One becomes two, becomes four, becomes eight, et cetera. So you've got one donor, 1,000 patients can be treated.
1,000 patients. Yep, that's the goal.
And then will we do further things like, okay, which donors' tissues, which donor cells tend to be less eliciting of a
response? Uday, the interesting thing we know about cell culture, the more passages of cells, the less antigenic the cells become. So, I think the holy grail for ocular surface stem cell transplantation You know, we're building centers that understand how to do the surgery and how to immunosuppress. What we ultimately want to get to is cultured limbal stem cells and cultured ocular surface epithelium. Because number one, not that it's terribly difficult, but we like to use living related tissue because we can tissue match them. The rejection rate's way lower than using a deceased donor. But that hurdle of getting a corneal surgeon comfortable with immunosuppression is a huge hurdle. It is, and you need a nurse, a transplant coordinator. Cultured cells become much, much, much less antigenic, to the point where we've had some discussions with cell culture biologists that maybe you need very little systemic immunosuppression, or maybe none with an ocular surface transplant. Now think about then every single corneal surgeon will do ocular surface transplantation if I can take the immunosuppression piece of the puzzle out of it.
Yeah,
right. It's estimated there are 150 to 200,000 blind people in the U.S. alone with ocular surface stem cell deficiency. We're not even treating 1% of them.
Yeah.
No, and that's here in this country. There's another initiative, Uday, I'd like to tell you about. We have had retired injured military that have come to us. We've had active military, come to us. So one of my patients is a Navy SEAL, and he had an explosion, and he's been in my waiting room talking to military people. And he said, "Well, how did you get here?" And because his experience was, he was told that he had to stay blind in this eye. He had a bad chemical thermal injury, and they said, "Well, nobody can fix that eye. So your other eye is not bad. You go just live with it." And he's a young guy, and he didn't want to do it. And so, a funny story. He says he finally gets sent to me. He finally gets referred to one of my former fellows who said, "You got to go to Cincinnati." So I walk in the room, and he stands up, shakes my hand. He said, "Before we start a consultation, I got to ask you a question. Why am I not in New York? Why am I not in Dallas? Why am I not in LA? Why am I not in Chicago? Why am I in Cincinnati?" And I said, "Well, you better sit down because it gets worse. You're actually in Kentucky." My practice is on the Kentucky side of Cincinnati. So it's even worse than you think you're in Ohio. He got a laugh out of it. But he put us onto this. How many military are in need? So he and I started this project to figure out how many, wounded military, from eye injuries, because we've taken care of a lot of them. So if you look at the longest running war we've ever had as a nation is the Middle East back-to-back theaters of Iraq and Afghanistan. That's our longest war. It's estimated there are 36,000 blind soldiers.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
And a lot of them are the explosion of the IED that destroys the whole globe and the retina. But in getting access to some of the injury reports, and there's a registry, about 10% of them seem to be the front of the eye, cornea. And so we have an initiative to try to actually get access and then get the Department of Defense or the Defense Health Agency to allow our foundation's teamwork to take care of it, because the military has no one. They have several ophthalmology centers, but they don't do any of this work. And I'll give you an example. This young, he's part of, when we tell our story, he's a perfect example. So this a young guy was in Afghanistan. There was a big explosion. A bunch of people in his platoon died. He had burns to both eyes. He gets airbagged to Germany, then sent to Army military base in San Antonio. Okay. And, at that time, his eyes were quiet. He's about a year out. They quiet his eye down. But, both eyes are opaque corneas. Now, from his history, he has limbal stem cell deficiency. Goes and they do a penetrating keratoplasty. It fails. And then he gets an honorable discharge. And they said, there's nothing we can do for you. So he goes back home. By the way, he has 8 children.
Oh, wow.
And he served this country, has a Purple Heart, and he's told to accept blindness. And so they go to a major university in Southeast United States and has a penetrating keratoplasty in the other eye. course, that fails, right? No stem cells fails. He then goes back home, and he's kind of a bitter guy, which I think we all would be.
Yeah, I can't blame him.
He goes and gets Boston carotid prosthesis in the first eye. And again, that's not the worst choice, although ocular surface stem cell transplantation with limbal efficiency is a much better choice.
Sure.
We default sometimes to the Boston Capra, which is an amazing invention, but in a severe dry with limbal deficiency, the complication rate's high. Well, he had a wound leak, corneal melt, and got a pseudomonas endophthalmitis and lost his eye.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
So now he's home for another year or two. And finally, you know, his wife is demanding the regional ophthalmologist, you know, she would not take no for an answer. So he finally gets sent up to me. And I tell you, the first time I met him, he was in his fatigues. His eight kids were from ages 1 to like 13 were destroying my exam room. And he would not even talk to me. He was just dropping F-bombs, and, you know, he was just an angry, angry guy. And so I said to his wife, listen, I don't blame your husband one bit. You know, the Army's failed him. You know, several major universities have failed him, but I know his history and I can kind of have a look at his eye. You know, I think we have a really good chance of getting his vision back. I said, but I can't deal with him. So you get an attitude adjustment and then I'll be back. So 2 hours later, she comes out of the hallway and she says, Dr. Holland, my husband's ready to talk to you. Then it was, yes, sir. No, sir. What do you want me to do, sir? You know, he was just, and you know, to his credit, he's an incredible person. His wife is an amazing person. His eight kids are, he's 20, 30, and wow. He's driving. He, you know, he's a wrestling coach. His kids are in, you know, wow. Are national wrestlers. And you know, he's got his life back, you know. I mean,
right.
But, you know, so what failed him was, everyone told him there was nothing to do, you know, like this. I had a med student from Ohio that was helping us, his uncle, and he got anhydrous ammonia, you know, in his face. And so he went to a famous university and they did the acute therapy for him, you know, stabilize his eye. And then he, you know, went back home and they said, there's nothing to do. And he's, you know, this guy is, he's about ready to start his first year of medical school. And he said, you know, back then it was probably 2015 or 2014. He said, are you kidding me? You can't tell me there's nothing for me. The cornea specialist told him, listen, learn Braille and get an exercise bike.
Oh, my goodness.
That's what this guy was told. I mean, you talk about a guy. So he goes through, as we're rehabilitating his eyes, through medical school with his wife and his sisters reading his textbooks to him.
Wow.
He gets through medical school. We get his vision back. He's a hospitalist now.
That's amazing.
Two fellowships, but he tells that story. Learn Braille, get an exercise bike. You know, move on with your life. You know it's we all, you know, we don't expect every cornea person to do this, but we all have to understand there are options for these patients, and we have to stop doing repeat penetrating keratoplasties. Not only do they not work, but Uday, what happens when you get multiple grafts that fail and reject, you increase the immune status of the patient. So our risk of rejection is so much higher. Right. They'd be better off if they never saw the cornea guy, you know.
Well, then we got to do a better job of educating each other, educating ophthalmologists, so we know that with like his history, it's very obvious. The PK is gonna fail. Don't even try it.
So I'll have you sometime this week when you get a little moment, I want you to look in the September issue of Cornea.
Okay.
So I wrote an editorial and this was after this patient I saw. So every clinic, I see a patient who's either told there's nothing to do and the patient finds us by themselves or their family, or they've had multiple PKs, or they say to the patient, you can go to Cincinnati, but you're going to be put on drugs and you're going to die. I mean, I have this kid from New York I just saw who was actually referred to me, but that's what they told him. He's 22. He said, I don't want to die. You know, I can learn to live blind. I said to him, you don't have to die. I mean, you have a good prognosis. But because of that initial consultation with a cornea specialist in New York, his mind is if he takes these meds, he's going to die, and he's refusing surgery.
What?
So I saw this patient from a well-known institution. She has Stevens-Johnson syndrome. She had 7 PKs in her right eye, 7 PKs in her left eye, 14 failed PKs. And I'm like, at what point do you stop? You know, so I was so upset. It just makes me angry, you know, clinic after clinic after clinic. So I emailed Ollie Jalilian. Ollie is the head of, he's the cornea specialist at University of Chicago who's doing these, you know. Yeah. And he trained with me. And I said, Ollie, I just saw this patient. I got to ask you a question. Am I this angry old guy, or should I write an editorial calling out our specialty? And he writes back, yes to both. you are an angry old guy. And so we wrote an editorial basically saying we as a specialty have to do better, right? And we outlined all the obstacles, systemic immunosuppression, transplant quarter not being paid for, you know, complex surgery, reimbursement not very good. It doesn't matter. It's like saying if you have a retina, saying if you had a repeat retinal detachment, we're not going to do it. You know what I mean? To me, it's one of the most ignored, mismanaged, unmet needs in certainly in cornea, right? So the first draft of the editorial got immediately rejected, and it came back from the reviewer, way too caustic, rhetoric too caustic. So we watered it down 4 times, and we finally got it published. But, you know, Udi, take a read. We do acknowledge every cornea person does need to do this. But number one, recognize liberal deficiency. Number two, you know, help create regional centers. Every cornea center doesn't need to do it, but create regional centers where we can all support a cornea person that right. will be your regional center. And we can find regional corneal surgeons that want to do this. And then financially support, because that person is going to help your area. Because there are these patients everywhere.
I mean, listen, then next time I see a patient of this type of injury or issue, I'm calling up Marjan Fareed. Hey, I got a present for you. Please,
Marjan has them. Her team is amazing. She got a great transplant coordinator, very supportive chairman, and she went from doing a handful on her own without a transplant coordinator, just trying to do it because Roger really pushed her to do it, to now having a full team, and you know, she's taking care of over 100 patients now with liberal deficiency, just in that short period of time that we have created her center.
We've got to recruit you a military ophthalmologist, military cornea specialist, to come train with you too.
Well, we had talked. It's interesting because I've had lots of conversations with. There's 4 vision centers of excellence in the military created because of this issue of all the 36,000, but they rotate somebody, you know, and they don't have the ancillary help. Like they don't do where the ophthalmologists are. They don't do a renal transplant. So they won't have a transplant cord. They may not have glaucoma oculoplastics. We think it's better for the military to allow our system. And who is more deserving to get their vision back than someone who's fought for this country and gone blind? I mean, we owe it to these kids.
Oh, for sure. Gone blind doing their national.
Yes. Defending our world.
Right. Yeah. No, I'm with you 100% on that. So if you had to get a message, our podcast is really popular for the ophthalmologists in the 30s and 40s. Like this podcast will get 1,000 video views and it'll get 10,000 audio listens. It'll be huge.
You didn't tell me it was video.
It's video too, but only about 1,000 ophthalmologists watch the video. But what's the important message to get out to them then? So if you see this type of patients, think about the, I mean, what message do you get to them?
Well, I mean, you know, I think everyone should understand the signs of liberal stem cell deficiency, right? History is really important. If you've got a guy that corneas went opaque from anhydrous ammonia, from acid, what, you know, just by history, you only have to examine the patient, you know, the diagnosis, you know, so understand. But, you know, we see it with mitomycin toxicity and glaucoma. We see it in contact lens wear. You know, every single, you know, it's interesting. Obviously, contact lenses are tremendously successful, but sure. It's the number four reason why we do limbal stem cell transplantations, contact lens.
Really?
Because of, you know, it's an ischemic phenomenon. However, it's not like years of wear and wearing them overnight, because we've seen them in daily wear patients after 2 years. There's got to be some kind of, you know, predisposition to not doing well with some decreased oxygen. So all those patients could be cured by just looking for the signs of limbal deficiency at 12 o'clock and stopping their contacts. And we shouldn't have to take a patient who has contact lens wear and get total limbal deficiency, but it happens all the time. So know the signs of, you know, loss of the palisades and votes, thickened abnormal epithelium, late staining, right? The conjunctival epithelium, it doesn't stay bright green because there's a defect. The fluorescein seeps through the abnormal, you know, cell junctions and takes this dull green appearance. That's pathognomonic for limbal deficiency in that quadrant. And then if you see a patient with that history diagnosis, Steven Johnson, graft versus host. Graft versus host is amazing. Graft versus host causes a lot of limbal deficiency. They're easy to fix, Uday. You know why? We take the bone marrow. I just did one today. A guy had a bone marrow transplant from his brother, got GVHD, went bilaterally blind. We fixed his first eye about 6 months ago. We used the bone marrow donor. He can't reject the conjunctival limbus. That's self. That's immune self. They're easy to fix. They don't get sent to us. They're told there's nothing to do. I mean, graft versus host disease, because we don't have to immune suppress them. They can't reject the conjunctival limbus from their brother or their donor, you know. But then obviously get them to a cornea person that understands it. And then as cornea people, stop doing cornea transplants.
Yeah.
Or scraping an amnion membrane. We see scraping, AMT, AMT. You know, AMT has a definite role in corneal disease.
Sure.
It doesn't treat limbal deficiency. You know, it can stabilize corneas with partial deficiency, but it's not going to treat patients with extensive or total limbal deficiency. And then if you don't want to take care of these patients, try to get them to someone who really wants to try to take care of them.
Do you guys have a website up for this?
We do. It's Holland Foundation. Just look up Holland Foundation. And we have a website that tells.
I'll put a link down below for our viewers and listeners.
Yeah. And it tells our mission. And yeah, in fact, this Saturday, we have 23 surgeons coming to Covington, Kentucky for our second annual ocular surface stem cell transplant meeting. Surgeons from all over the country, and we just hope to grow it. And you know, we are slowly chipping away at getting people trained and getting these patients taken care of.
Yeah, you can never retire. Sorry, man. this is too much of a passion project. You're gonna change the way this is done, right? The same way that the endothelial cell transplantation.
Well, that ultimately, if we get to that point, then the big roadblocks go away.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, you brought up a good point earlier where you say, God, I saw a patient that had each eye had 7 PKs. I mean, how much is enough, right? It's just, after the second or third, it's going to fail. You already know it's going to fail.
Yeah, it's amazing. So there was a orthopedic surgeon. He was a team surgeon for an NFL team.
Okay.
Got graft versus host. His wife is a very well-known surgeon in their region as well, oncology surgeon. And he GVHD, you know, they get him in scleral lenses. He still sees for a while. He's still bright. Then all of a sudden, that conjunctiva goes right over the center of both pupils, and his vision goes to count fingers. Went to four or five places, and all of them said there's absolutely nothing to do. And, you know, several places said, you know, how about a Boston caper? No, because your eye's too dry, nothing to do. A family friend was a retina surgeon, and a retina surgeon said, I think there's a guy in Cincinnati. You might want to just look him up. His wife looks us up. They come to visit us, and I say, not that everything is easy, but you're not as complex as you think, because who was your bone marrow donor? It was my brother.
We need to get him over here.
Get your brother. We he was on a little bit of mycophenolate for his GVHD of his skin and his GI. So we're going to bump up your mycophenolate a little bit. That's all we're going to do. And those cells will be his, you know. And so, you know, he's back to 20/30 now, and is better. You know, he couldn't see his grandkids. He wow. couldn't drive. You know, this is an orthopedic surgeon. And he said his wife, you know, he kind of, you know, I think felt a little bit defeated, you know, after this went on. And his wife was like, this is 2019. You can't tell me ophthalmology hasn't figured this out yet. I mean, she's like, this is, she's screaming at everybody. And I don't blame her, you know.
Right.
You know, so she's, they've been very supportive of what we do. And you know, and he's doing tremendous.
Wow, that is fantastic. Do you have a 5-6-7 minute video of anything you could share? I can host that the very next day and send it out to our 100,000 subscribers.
So we have a great video that tells our story. It's back to back videos. I think they're each about 3 minutes. Could I send those to you?
Absolutely. Be happy to host those too.
Wonderful. Those
do a ton of views. Now, this is fantastic. You know, I actually learned a lot by just talking today. It was great for my personal education. I think our listeners and viewers also sincerely appreciate it.
Well, I can talk all day about this. Most people don't want to listen.
No, it's fascinating. It's just because it's, you know, I think there's even a hole in residency teaching where this is I'd have to go back and look in the basic science curriculum that the academy makes and that all residents in the U.S. use. Is this even covered?
You know, there's always a question on limbal deficiency, but I don't think there's a lot on the prognosis and the outcome. For instance, most cornea specialists in academic cornea, they equate, so the procedure we do from a deceased donor is called keratolimbal allograft. We wrote a paper on this years ago trying to get the nomenclature straightened out because there was six names for the same procedure, and then the same name was used for multiple. So we kind of cleaned that up. So keratolimbal allograft is when you use sclera, limbus, and peripheral cornea segment to transfer stem cells. Most cornea people think keratolimbal allograft equals ocular surface stem cell transplantation. It's not the procedure we do most of the time. 75% of the time, we do a living-related conjunctival limbal allograft. We use the conj as the carrier for several reasons. One, we get HLA type of rejection rates much lower. Two, many of the diseases we take care of need conj. Stevens-Johnson syndrome, graft versus host has bad conj. Chemical injuries have bad conj. So the conjunctival carrier of the limbus is just as important as the limbus. So it's a way better operation than the keratolimbal allograft, of which we're not getting any conj. It's basically just limbal stem cells. So, you know, when I get invites to be on these national programs, please talk about keratolimbal allograft. I'm like, well, I will, but I don't do that very often. I do. You know? It tells me they don't. These are you know, corny people leading our education, and they don't get it.
Right. It just takes time. You got to keep chipping away at it.
I will do my best, and I really appreciate you. You know, when you sent me that email, I'm like, okay, Uday's just going to be a pain in my side here. But it's been a delightful time chatting with you. It's just very easy to do, and I really appreciate you having me on.
Oh, my pleasure. And please send me those videos. I'll feature them right after this. It'll be on the same. It'll be all together, and we can all learn together.
I will do that.
All right, awesome. Now I want to remind our viewers and listeners, remember, we've got a new podcast every Sunday, everywhere you find your podcast, Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, you name it. Plus, of course, we have a new Cataract Coach surgery video every single day. So until next time, I'll check you later. But hey, keep watching. We're featuring those videos right now.
There's an estimate that there are some several hundred thousand people in the United States that could have their eyesight restored. Either they don't know about it, or they don't have a facility near them that could do it.
We specialize in what's called severe ocular surface disease, and those are patients that have injuries to the eye like acid or alkali injuries or chronic severe medical problems that cause them to scar the surface of the eye. And severe ocular surface disease patients end up with loss of the skin-producing cells called the limbal stem cells, and then corneal scarring and unfortunately, severe blindness.
I had what was called an eyeball scraping, and they scraped the scar tissue from your eye. Well, that was awesome because, of course, you see so clear, and you're like, oh my gosh, this is it. Well, it only lasted 3 months.
I would get these corneal transplants, and in a short period of time, rejection process would start to happen.
There are a lot of excellent corneal transplant surgeons in the United States. It's actually the most common tissue transplanted. Routine or standard corneal transplantation has a fantastic success rate. But we're not actually talking about that. We're talking about transplanting the surface of the eye. It's really like an organ transplant.
He is one of the only doctors that does this particular technique.
My doctor in LA advised me that I should see Dr. Holland about this.
She said, I've done all I can do. She said, but I know a guy in Cincinnati. I know a doctor there that I think he can help you.
He explained to us why my corneas rejected in the past. So every cornea that they transplanted, it would put in a new cornea, but it had no stem cells around it to feed it, to nurture it, and to heal and to protect it. And because it didn't have that, your body would kind of invade it and attack it. We figured that out. Corneal stem cells, we can transplant corneal surface stem cells. That will produce the surface and the protection that you never had.
We've taken specialists at Cincinnati Institute, and we've taken a very supportive hospital, St. Elizabeth Hospital. And then the other connection is the medical team. We've partnered with the nephrologists who run the kidney transplant program at University of Cincinnati. And also, we've partnered with the nephrologist of the kidney transplant program at Children's Hospital in Cincinnati. The person we don't have in a typical cornea transplant ophthalmology practice is a transplant coordinator. And that's the key person if you were going to have an organ transplant.
Well, it's a lot involved, a lot of phone calls, a lot of emails, but a lot of communication between the patient, you know, kind of you're the middleman between the patient and the doctors.
She organizes everything, all the multiple appointments the patient needs and all the different medications and side effects that we have to track. Everybody has come together to create a team that we don't see anywhere else in the United States.
This is a national leading program. We have people from 49 of the 50 states come to St. Elizabeth Healthcare to have this done by Dr. Holland. So it is something unique and special. But anytime you're having someone travel from all 49 states, that becomes very expensive.
He said, 3 years prior to my surgery, you have to go and see Ed Holland. And I said, well, where is he? Oh, he's in Ohio. I said, well, doc, you act like that's around the corner. How am I going to do that?
I tell patients it's not easy for someone who lives in Cincinnati. It's certainly not easy for our patients who live in California due to the amount of lab work and follow-ups with us. You know, the first year, some patients are seen, we say, around 8 to 10 times.
The wait times that these patients have, the financial obstacles of providing transportation, providing lodging, providing additional testing. What ultimately we want to do is take the knowledge that's here and have it opened up across the country to address patients in the local community. Educate them that they know that there's hope. Educate the doctors that they know that they can treat these patients.
What we need to build is centers of excellence throughout the United States.
It's important because you don't realize how much you take for granted, your sight or anything else, until it's gone. And if you could have something even more close, or something more than you know, just Dr. Holland by himself or a couple of people that can do it, so much more people could be serviced.
Our objective would be that there'll never be a person that will go untreated because they couldn't afford it. At this point in time, we're not there, but that's what our objective is. We are raising money to establish a foundation that will give us the income we need to be able to do that.
You may be responsible for bringing this program, this nationally renowned program, to your region of the country. So why would you not want to be a part of that?
You have an opportunity to make a difference. You have an opportunity to give the gift of sight to patients who, without those financial resources, will live a life in which they're blind.
I was 2400 and now I am 2020. I don't need glasses.
My vision is back to normal, maybe even better than it was before.
This is life-changing. And not just enhancement. You know, it's like it makes your life a little nicer. It's life-changing.
It's just such a beautiful gift to give someone so that they can see again.
If I had kept on the path that I was on, I wouldn't be sitting here today being able to see.